What's up, gang? Van Jackson here. A while back, a friend of the pod asked me what subscriptions I'd recommend for news and analysis on world politics. And it was actually a hard question to answer on the spot, believe it or not. But I've got a great answer now. Mother effin' World Politics Review. If you're a fan of Undiplomatic, you should be reading World Politics Review. It's obviously worldly. It's in the title. It's not obsessed with Trump. And it has a great mix of analysis and journalism. Also, why do you think I'm doing this pitch? World Politics Review is an official sponsor of the show. And the best way to back us right now is to back them. So give them a chance. They're offering a 25% discount subscription for Undiplomatic listeners. And if you want to subscribe to their daily newsletter, which you should, you can do it for free. Just visit wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That's wpr.pub/undiplomatic. That'll get you the free newsletter, and it'll also provide you the code for the 25% discount should you want to subscribe. So get on the train, wpr.pub/undiplomatic. Peace. What's up, gang? Thanks for listening to the Undiplomatic Podcast, the show with undiplomatic takes about the foreign policy scene. I'm your host, Van Jackson. Full house today in the studio. Pete McKenzie, Kiara Mitchell, Jake Dello. Jake overslept the last episode, and that's why he wasn't in there.
What a call out. Holy crap.
I gotta put him on blast.
That took all of 5 seconds. And I was thinking, you know, maybe we're just going to, who cares where Jake was just last week. But yes, I slept in.
It's the risk you take by having students on the show is that...
That's so the vibe of this podcast is instant call out. It's just like,
yeah.
Oh, man.
Undiplomatic, right? So two quick hits before we get into the show proper. One is that it's getting muted by fucking coronavirus nonsense, which we'll also give a quick hit to. But there's an oil price war happening, if you're not paying attention, between fucking Russia and Saudi Arabia. This has Armageddon written all over it. So if you don't know, OPEC, so the oil cartel that Saudi is central to, that sort of rigs the oil market, basically has been working with Russia in something called OPEC Plus since 2016. A month ago, Russia said, oh, we're not going to coordinate our, we're not going to be part of the cartel anymore. Like, we're just not going to, we're not going to engage in our mafioso collective action.
The only time Russia has said no to cartel behavior ever.
That's right. That's right. And so Russia, all of a sudden, has decided that they want to preserve market share by dropping prices. They're not going... Basically, Saudi Arabia wanted to hold back oil supply so that they could jack the price up. That would force Russia to export less, you know? And Russia didn't want to do that, so they said, fuck you. And then so Saudi said, no, 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 fuck you. And so Saudi decided to undercut Russian prices. And so that's where we are. And there's a professor at Brown University named Jeff Colgan, who he writes about this stuff. He's written about what he calls petro-aggression before, how, like, you know, when you're an oil-funded economy, you're more likely to aggress your neighbors and be involved in bad shit. And he had this good piece in the Washington Post. I'll try to link to it. But basically, he was arguing actually that this oil price suppression, so it's going to hurt the U.S. economy. It's going to hurt the U.S. in a number of ways. But he was thinking actually this might curb petro-aggression because you require money to fund your war machine. And so when you're fighting conflicts in Yemen or in Syria, in the case of Saudi and Russia respectively, you need money. And you don't have it if you're trying to, you know, lose money to undercut the competition in the oil market. So he had almost a pseudo optimistic take, right? It was like, yes, it's going to hurt the U.S. economy, but maybe it helps Saudi Arabia and Russia, you know, get themselves out of conflicts. It could go the exact opposite way, though. I don't know that it's, you know, worth the optimism. Then the more interesting thing was he blasted on I should have put this in Stay Off Twitter, but Jeff Colgan posited that there were, you know, two competing motivations or schools of thought about, like, why Russia would suddenly do this. Mm. Like, why would they suddenly pull out of the cartel? And he said one is like, look, they just want market share. You know, if the economy is coming down, they need to preserve their ability to export oil. And then he's like, the other one is more nefarious. It's that they're trying to fuck with the U.S. They're trying to harm the U.S. economy. And on the face of it, it sounds like a little conspiratorial, but Russia's foreign policy is also notoriously the middle finger foreign policy. Yeah. They're all about fucking the U.S. So it's interesting because now that we have these like competing hypotheses, we can think through, okay, what do we need to see happen to confirm one or the other?
Yeah.
And that should inform then what we do as a result.
MBS is obviously the driving political force in Saudi Arabia. And a few days before this oil crisis erupted, or it was announced, it became clear that four other members of the royal family, all of whom to varying extents were threats to his kind of authority and his status as the presumptive heir to the throne, had been arrested and detained. So the former crown prince, that prince's son, all sorts of people like this. And this caused a huge eruption because people were freaking out that either the king was dying or dead. This was like a next challenge to the throne. And then this oil crisis hits the news. And it became really clear that after a year of lying low after the Khashoggi killings, that MBS was still willing to fuck with people, that MBS was still willing to cause absolute chaos. And it was really interesting because it was like people had for a year thought that maybe MBS had calmed down, maybe MBS was like tempering his impulsive instincts. And that is clearly not the case.
Yeah, not so much. So anyway, shout out to Jeff Colgan. The other quick hit is about the coronavirus, which won't fucking go away. I hate it. I don't want this to be... This is not the COVID-19 podcast. I don't...
Controversial take. Van does not like a pandemic.
I'm anti-pandemic.
Yeah, which has been declared now by
by CNN.
World Health Organization.
More importantly, CNN.
CNN did it a few days before and they admitted it, but the World Health Organization this morning declared it a pandemic.
And that is the nature of this shout-out, quick hit. I don't know what to call it, but Pete found this article on foreignpolicy.com about basically the fucking failure of the World Health Organization. And we would have done an armchair analysis, except I fucking hate talking about COVID-19 because this isn't the epidemiology podcast. And but it's the article was actually very interesting in the sense that it was highlighting kind of a failure of neoliberal institutionalism and collective action. And that's, I don't know, like if you're going to have an IR take on a pandemic, that's an interesting one to have because it gets into debates about theory.
I hate to be a bit angsty, man, but I asked two coronavirus questions and I got put on a moratorium and now we're having quick hits. What is that? I was told after two that you took away a hell of a lot of ammo for prediction market.
No offense to anybody who has coronavirus, but like, it's so fucking stupid. It's not worth talking about other than wash your hands. Is this the wash your hands podcast? Like, what the fuck? It's the mass production of masks podcast? Like, what are we going to do with this information?
The new pod merch is going to be branded hand sanitizer.
That's so good.
70% alcohol, so it kills there we coronavirus.
Go. Oh, maybe we can get away with 70% alcohol content. Let's talk about that for 10 minutes. I can't fucking do it, man. I can't
madness.
Do it. I can't.
We'll finish this up here, but the one thing that I do want to comment on...
It's real, I mean, but...
It is definitely real. The funniest thing, if you haven't seen it, is that New York State is now producing its own soap. Hand sanitizer to address the coronavirus outbreak, made with prison labor, which I think is just like the apotheosis of all American discussion of COVID-19. It's just insane. Yeah, basically, man.
I think it's Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Yeah.
He said it was lavender. It smelled like lavender in his interview about it.
Smells like lavender?
Yep.
Smells like prison sweat. Yeah, that's probably what it smells like.
Actual fuck.
The one thing I would say is that there's a lesson in this for the theoreticians or wannabes or whoever, you know, basically everybody who listens to this show. Liberal foreign policy is appropriate or not appropriate entirely depending on the context. You cannot run an objectively liberal foreign policy, damn the consequences. That's not rational, and liberal foreign policy is rational. And so what we're finding now is like multilateral institutions that were designed to prevent, like the WHO, designed to prevent the global spread of a pandemic, completely falls on its face. We never escaped the collective action problem. International cooperation is harder than many liberals presuppose. And it's not that you shouldn't try to establish these things, but when you are making a foreign policy that is a liberal foreign policy, you're making a bet. The likelihood of that bet working depends entirely on circumstances. The circumstances are more Hobbesian than we would want to acknowledge. So that's my
grim
flex.
Take
I don't know
COVID
what the
19.
Fuck. Yeah. I don't even know if I used the word flex right there. Okay.
Elder millennial strikes again. Yeah.
Okay, next segment.
Let's do Prediction Market, where we get Van to predict outcomes from today's current events and keep track of them. All right, for Prediction Market this week, I've come to take back control of the shit show that was last week. Oh. I don't know what very tired and underslept person wrote out those questions the night before, but whoever they had the smarts not to turn up the next day.
Yeah.
Okay. Question one: will there be a formal declaration of war between Turkey and Russia over the Idlib crisis before August?
So it looks imminent that the two countries are going to be fighting. But Russia, the way Russia fights now, like we saw in Ukraine, is the kind of hybrid war model. Like, you don't need to declare war if you're Russia. It's actually much better if you don't.
Yeah.
Just send in the little green man and no, we're not Russian. Das Vidanya.
Yeah. No, I'm silly.
AK-47. So I'm going to say no, but I don't mean that Turkey and Russia aren't going to clash. I think that's kind of like baked in.
They bought fighter jets off them. Who do they think they're fighting? Like, they know what we got.
The insanity of insanity of sphere of influence politics in Syria.
It just seemed like two best friends that just really got angry at each other really quick. So yeah.
Well, I don't know if you guys have seen Narcos on Netflix, but like the current two seasons, the most recent ones, are like about the consolidation of Mexican cartels. When you're bad guys doing bad shit, collective action is even harder than in normal circumstances, right? And so you're going to end up, like in Mexico, the cartels, they consolidated for a while, and one guy was the hegemon who imposed stability through, you know, force and fear and coercion, etc. Eventually that breaks down. When it broke down, it was a decade plus of cartel wars, you know, until somebody reasserts hegemony. And so it's like cooperation is hard. It's even harder between bad guys. And so that's my take on Turkey and Syria.
Well, funnily enough, the comparison between Russia and a mafiosi family is going to come up later on in this segment.
There we go.
But we'll do question two first. And I'm going to say this without crying. Given Joe Biden's dramatic lead in delegates, will Bernie drop out before the Democratic National Convention? They're not going to do that to themselves again, are they?
I think Bernie might drop out before this episode airs.
No, surely not.
It's the writing is on the wall. Joe Mentum, fabricated though it is, now exists. Everybody is, you know, CNN has basically turned Bernie off and everyone's like, thank God. So we're stuck. There's a point at which you have to have unity or else Trump wins by default.
Yeah, totally.
And even if there's unity, Trump might still win. Yeah. So like, we gotta fake the orgasm.
Yeah,
big
yeah.
time.
A lot of the Bernie bros on Twitter are saying that they don't want to vote for Joe and they will write third party people in. Please don't repeat.
This is not 2016, man.
Please do not repeat it. I do not want to be sitting in front of my TV.
Are you incapable of learning? Are you fucking kidding me? I just can't do it. I can't even comment.
You know, last week it actually turned out the day she dropped out, I figured out I'd officially support Elizabeth Warren, and then that's the day she drops out. I was like, oh well, that was
bad
fun.
Luck, yeah.
That was a fun campaign trail. Yeah, I jinxed it. Question three: will Vladimir Putin succeed in securing another two presidential terms and changing the Russian constitution on their vote on April 22nd?
Yes, he will.
Fuck, that's scary.
It's a bold prediction. It's a bold prediction that the lead oligarch will stay in power. But I think he will, and I think he will do what he wants because he is the state. It's very it's quite simple. So that's I would be shocked if Putin were not at the center of Russian both conspiracy and fake democracy going forward.
Does he have any limits?
I don't think so.
Because it's all coming to a head now. He's like, okay, the world's dying from a flu. You know what? Let's kick this shit up again.
He has been limited in the past by the need to play the game of pretending like we're a democracy.
Yeah.
And so that acts as a form of constraint, but it's like a pretty thin constraint. I mean, everybody sees through the veil. They know what's going on. And he's fine with that. That is like literally, that is no problem for him, you know?
Well, that's the mafiosi comparison coming back, because the Godfather probably didn't care that you knew he was a criminal either. But as long as you just didn't say it in public,
that's right.
You were fine.
Obey the invisible rules.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Time for Stay Off Twitter, where we curate the best and worst of Twitter so that you don't have to.
Okay, for Stay Off Twitter, first tweet is, these are like kind of complicated tweets actually, but they are some of the best, as in interesting, tweets that I've ever come across. And this is like uniquely sourced to Twitter. Like, you're not going to get this anywhere else. So stay off Twitter, but listen to this. So a buddy of mine, Rush Doshi, who, you know, he's like Ivy League pedigreed, et cetera, but he's affiliated with Yale's China Center, and he's a fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he's like part of the Asian security watcher community. Legit guy. I think he's even affiliated with a think tank that I'm affiliated with in D.C., and the Yale China Center and Brookings have some funding from one of Alibaba's co-founders, Joe Tsai, and so do like a lot of people, right? This is capitalism. That's how it works, unfortunately. And, you know, you got to have money to function. And guess who's got money? The bad guys. So anyway, Rush, he's a legit scholar slash policy pundit guy. So he was commenting, as pundits do, on current events. And in response to China agreeing to supply Italy with ventilators and masks and donating, you know, protective suits and test kits and stuff. So China's making some donations to Italy to help Italy out because it's being fucked by the coronavirus that came from China. Rush, in response to that news, says, China is emerging as a global public goods provider as the U.S. proves unable and unwilling to lead. This is an important development, and if the trend continues, it's one with potentially serious consequences for the U.S. role in the world. And he's like, we need a thorough review of why the U.S. lacks the industrial capacity to do this and blah, blah, blah. It's very important that America play a role in furnishing global public goods. If the claim to leadership and centrality is to mean anything positive. And he has subsequent tweets where he's lamenting the fact that China is posturing like it's a global public goods provider, right? It's not functionally a global public goods provider. It's like symbolically one. And that's like a huge difference. And he's also lamenting the fact. So in response to that, some like malign motherfucker who is some operative in the Republican Party with a very large following. And he tweeted out, Rush Doshi is bought and paid for by China's Alibaba. Why doesn't he register as a foreign agent for the CCP? And so Rush, like, he almost doesn't need to defend himself. And even a bunch of my hawky China hawk, Uber hawk friends in Washington, slash former friends because of the podcast, they were defending Rush too. So Rush is, we're all part of like this community of like establishment people-ish. And like, he is definitely part of that. And even the Warhawk people are defending him as like, this is just slanderous. Where's your proof? You're making this shit up. You're causing problems. And it's all based on, like, I mean, according to this tweet, it's because Brookings and Yale get funding from Alibaba. And like, so does fucking everybody. And I doubt any of it's going directly into Russia's pocket. And then also, just in a broader sense, this is how think tanks function. Short of government funding, you get foreign funding, but your credibility as an institution is based on like independent research, independent voices. If what you're saying doesn't appear independent, you lose credibility, right? So none of that is at play here, which means this really is just McCarthyist kind of red baiting. And so I wanted to give a shout out to Rush Doshi, who is not a CCP agent, just to be clear, and fucking not shout out to whoever's being a bitch and acting like it's 1950s all over again. This communist red baiting stuff is absurd. And then it's super interesting that it highlights an opportunity for Warhawks to mainstream themselves, ironically, by being like, no, 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 we just want the war. We don't. This is not about racism. You're not.
In the tweet that replied to Rush's, they said, he needs to register as a CCP agent. Where do you do that? I want to find out where you go to sign the paper to say, yep, I'm a spy.
Oh, so actually there is there's a provision that you have to, I think it's with the FBI, you have to register as a foreign agent if you represent foreign interests and are lobbying the U.S. government. And think tanks don't have to do that, but some people think that think tanks should because they get foreign funding. So think tanks are kind of this loophole. But you actually do, you're being tongue-in-cheek, but like you actually do have to register as a foreign agent by law so that the FBI or whoever can keep tabs on you. So shout out to Rush Doshi. Matt Stoller, who is I don't know if he overtly endorsed Warren, but he is of the Warren mindset. He's affiliated with the Roosevelt Institution, which is, they focus on domestic economic, that's their agenda is economics, but they advocate policies that are strongly aligned with Warren. She's strongly aligned with the Roosevelt Institute. Mm. And Matt Stoller is famously a anti-monopolist, among other things. So capitalist, but very focused on inequality and the rigged game that is the American economy. Yeah. And he's actually got this book that I'm super psyched to read that I have not read called Goliath, about the history of corporate power and the anti-monopoly fight and how that's affected politics, blah, blah, blah. Super interesting. But he has this long tweet that I have to read almost verbatim because it's so good. He says, if it feels like an oh shit, everything we tried failed moment for progressives and the left, it is. Try to figure out what went wrong and how to change. I hate to say I told you so, but I've been pointing out that the left immolated itself under Obama in 2008, and they've never reckoned with their errors. The conservative movement didn't wait 20 years and take power. In 1964, Goldwater lost, but then in 1965, they influenced policy, and then in 1966, the conservatives won elections everywhere. The long game excuse is just that, an excuse. The left lost because their ideas were bad. There is the biggest fight within corporate America in our lifetimes and the biggest geopolitical realignment since the Cold War vis-a-vis China, and the left has nothing to say. Nothing. They don't even notice it. If you don't know anything about business, then you don't know anything about power in America. And then he plugs his book extensively. So this, I mean, the tweet thread is great. His insights are great. There's like a 30-second history lesson here about the progressive movement, which is like there were literally five approaches that Americans took to big business in reaction to like the excesses of the Industrial Revolution. At the extremes, it was, you know, socialism, state owns means of production, owns the railroads, that kind of thing, abolishing private property, basically. And then on the other end, you had laissez-faire, which was obviously the exact opposite, where it's like you let corporations run the world, like you let oligarchy reign. And then in between is where the progressives were. And there were three approaches. I'm not making this up, by the way. This is an actual history lesson. One was the antitrust approach. One was the regulatory approach. One was the compensation approach, right? So antitrust was about not letting big vertically integrated corporations exist, you know, trust busting, anti-monopoly. The regulation approach was about rules, like you control the behavior and practices of these beasts. And then compensation was about taxation and the welfare state and how do you like redistribute gains and that kind of thing. One of the many reasons progressives sort of failed ultimately was because they all agreed on that trajectory of like, oh, big business is a problem. They could not get agreement about which of these three things or which combination of these three things you wanted to do. And when you can't get your shit together for coordinated. This is like the collective action episode. That when you can't do collective action on behalf of your movement and your class, it's going to be these other interests. Literally, the workers who are the ones who are most, who showed most solidarity with socialism and the laissez-faire, who actually owned the economy and, you know, purchased democracy, basically. When you're caught in between those two forces and you don't have your shit together, ultimately you fail. That's kind of what happened. And so his, Matt Stoller's story, his take, it's throwing that in our faces in a way. And I think there's some truth to power here that I wanted to share. That's why I told the, or shared the tweet thread. The two caveats I would add is, like, when I said this on Twitter too, like, the left is much better at critiquing power than dealing with power or adapting to power or working with power or even understanding power. Like, your ability to critique does not mean you actually understand. And that's a just continuous problem with the left. And then the other thing is, like, and this was reflected in, you know, the doom and gloom of the Bernie campaign at the moment, which is, like, mass movements and the grassroots approach to politics, there are virtues in that. The deck is stacked in favor of the status quo when you're trying to do that within an oligarchic system. So, like, this is not the right strategy of politics for a system that is functionally undemocratic. Like, it's like you're ignoring how power is actually structured and you're like, my idealism will win the day. You know, people power. People power just is like, it's very unlikely to work in a fucking oligarchy, and that's what we've become.
Well, it's just like, people power is amazing, but when you're focused on people power to the exclusion of every other form of affecting the system,
and yes,
when your dedication to people power means that you cannot engage in other forms of affecting the system, you're just locking the door against yourself.
You're anti-technocracy, you're anti-expertise, yeah. You know?
Like, and that's not inevitable. Like, you can 100% be in favor of people power. You can 100% be in favor of mass movements. And you can still also affect the system from working in other ways. Like, it's just a self-defeating
This
approach.
Podcast is a marriage of the two.
Yeah, fuck. Yeah.
The revolution will be technocratic. That was the name of one of the episodes.
Welcome to Under the Medic Podcast, the bourgeoisie intellectual technocrat podcast of the year. I am alone on this hill.
But do
people
you see,
power is all it takes. Let's have a revolution. I call it now.
Do you see the virtues of pluralism, the progressive ideal, the ethos of this podcast, letting in a Marxist like Jake?
All the way through my mini monologue, Jake was just sitting on the couch, be like, what the fuck is going on? Like,
it's all about people power. It's all about people power.
And then Adam Smith, Pete McKenzie over here being like, I told you so.
Look, I'm just saying, I'm just making an observation. Like,
Lockean contractualism, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Also, like, there was a piece in this fucking tweet where he said, there is the biggest fight within corporate America in our lifetimes and the biggest geopolitical realignment since the Cold War vis-a-vis China. Hmm. Maybe he's overstating it a little bit, but, like, the fact that the left is not weighing in on these huge, high rupture, high dramatic, epochal change moments, and, like, you're not talking about China, you're still talking about, like, implementing the socialist dream. Hmm. Fuck, dude, you have to pay attention to reality at some point. Right. One of his big critiques is, because he's obviously like a Warren fan. I think he's not a Sanders fan. I don't know. But one of his critiques of Sanders continuously over time has been like, where is Sanders on fucking China? And he has said some stuff in, like, my own writings. I piece together, like, I impute or deduce what Sanders and others, like, will do as almost like a prediction. But I'm not working with a lot.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm working with principles and worldviews as opposed to evidence. And so and that's where we are, because that's how little the left weighs in on big, important shit like China.
Well, it's not so much an issue of focusing on other stuff. It's an issue of just apathy. Like, there doesn't seem to be any move whatsoever on the American left about China.
Hmm.
And you can't afford to be apathetic about China, because they're not apathetic about you.
That's right. Way to bring in Trotsky. You can't help yourself.
Sick of getting caught.
Oh, man, it's too good. It's too fucking good.
Yeah. I mean, so one of my concerns with Bernie all along, like, I like Bernie, one of my concerns with his support base is that it's purely aesthetic. they love the lifestyle of being a Bernie bro or whatever. They love posturing and not...
Chapo trap.
Yeah. Like the rage, that's the dirtbag fucking... Yeah. My fear was always that they are not interested in the substance of politics. Mm. And that is not a basis for meaningful change. That's a basis for, you know, flexing and then going and watching Netflix.
Yeah.
You know? I don't know. So shout out to Matt Stoller and what's left of democracy.
Let's jump into Armchair Analysis, where we dive into a different piece every week and tell you all about it. This week is an article in the New York Times called Of Course They Gave Up on Democracy by Ivan Krastev, I think that's how you pronounce it, and Stephen Holmes. The article notes the current decline in democracy's strength and spread around the world, and it attributes that, at least partly, to Western democratization attempts, so like the uncritical idealization of democracy and capitalism after 1989 is how they describe it. And basically, crises in the West, so like the Great Recession, spooked Eastern European countries who had been copying Western democracy, even if they weren't economically affected, so like Poland. They say that imitation of Western democracy is necessarily an asymmetrical relationship between a superior and an inferior, and that created like a lot of resentment amongst Eastern countries. And they also say that what they call the three-decade age of imitation inflicted serious damage on liberal democracy by putting to sleep the self-critical faculties of its leading politicians, so stagnating domestic reform and creating easy opportunities for charges of hypocrisy. And that combination of things meant that democratization attempts around the world started to fall apart, and that democracies, stable, what we thought were stable democracies, have started to like enter into speed wobbles. I don't agree with everything in the article, but I thought it was a really interesting look at... It was a really interesting take on the like narrative of democracy is dying that is increasingly common.
Yeah, I mean, so this is like a running theme in a lot of publications and books the past couple years. I mean, for good reason. The irony that it highlights is like the belief in the end of history and that we were all going to be liberals forever and ever sabotaged the whole fucking experiment.
Yeah.
Like that's the one of the biggest takeaways, and it's super ironic. And I mean, depending on your worldview, it's tragic or, haha, we told you so. If you're fucking Marxist.
No comment. I lament
Yeah. Somebody had this, I think Dan Nexon had this, like, you know, mathematical equation of, like, social democracy is greater than neoliberal centrism is greater than populist fascism. That's true. That's what we have to remember and keep repeating to ourselves as we go in the voting booth. Because nothing is worse than Trump out of the things that exist today. Maybe things will exist worse that are later. But out of all the things that are available to us today, nothing is worse than Trump. And that makes Biden, ergo, Biden is good. I've screwed myself with the Biden team, I'm pretty sure, because they solicited my CV. And right. I think in a normal universe, they would like want me on their team. But like the second they hear all this, you know, I don't even dislike him. I'm just...
He seems like a lovely guy.
I'm mostly concerned, A, about his ability to beat Trump, and B, the fact that he's not Warren. That's my... Yeah. Those are my issues. But, like, the big takeaway I had from this piece that I thought was great was their final point that you mentioned, which the ruling class today, people who are, like, in decision-making positions of power, in democracies everywhere, most notably, I think, in the U.S., but everywhere, the establishments, you know, such as they are, I'm doing air quotes, they are not equipped for a dangerous, illiberal world. They don't have the strategic conditioning. They're numb to the idea of like political danger or having to make hard choices because they grew up in an era where you didn't study this stuff and you didn't experience it either. Why? Because we were all going to be liberals forever and ever. Mm. Fucking end of history. You can chillax and get paid and be on the board of a Chinese fucking company. And there are some of us, not me, who still do that, and not red baiting here, right? But... but I have no problem calling out a problem when I see it, and this
no
is
offense,
a problem.
But
yeah. I'm not getting endorsements from any corporations anytime soon, except World Politics Review, wpr.pub/undiplomatic.
That was so good.
Oh,
yeah,
man,
that's
good.
Real. That's real. Yeah. So the current class of politicians, basically, I think, is not well suited for the global environment we're in. They're highlighting that. And that was one of the reasons, one of many reasons why I liked Sanders and I liked Warren so much. Mm. It's why I think the moment needs progressive advocacy, like in progressive leadership. But more than anything, we just need to not embrace fascism. Yeah. And so that should be the priority right now. 5-meter targets before the 50-meter targets, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think the basic focus on dealing with your own shit before you try and deal with other people's shit. And that's a good lesson to take in all areas of life.
Yeah, yeah. So. It's interesting, like, a lot of people are converging from, like, very different worldviews on the need to, like, salvage liberalism, despite, like, almost everyone except for the establishment being a critic of liberalism. Yeah. And it's like, oh, we all had a decent thing going when, like, Starbucks was functional and, like, that was the default coffee or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not the best. It's not barista
right.
level,
but
you know.
It'll do.
Yeah. And, like, you'd much rather walk down the street and see a Starbucks than see a fucking, I don't know, like a Nazi flag. And so...
Tight.
Yeah.
rather Starbucks than a swastika.
Yeah.
Controversial, I know.
Truth to power. All right.
Oh, man.
All right, time for Ask Me Anything, where people ask me anything.
For Ask Me Anything this week, we've got one from a Washingtonian. I think this is probably Washington, D.C., not Washington State.
Yeah, that's usually Washingtonian. Yeah.
Yeah. Will you endorse Joe Biden?
Wow. Cutting to the quick. Well, for one thing, I don't think he needs my endorsement. But my ability to mobilize perhaps dozens of voters. So, yes, unquestionably, I need Bernie to drop out first. But yeah, like, I'm going to be all in, riding with Biden. I'm going to buy that Biden hoodie, you know, it's like, because that's what we have to do to stop the Nazi flag taking over Starbucks. I don't even go to Starbucks, you know, like that's Starbucks over Nazis. Right. That's the meme. That's the meme that's coming out of this episode.
Starbucks over swastikas.
It's the number one.
Starbucks, not swastikas. Yeah. So I'm riding with Biden.
With Joe Biden, I don't want to be intentionally inflammatory, but I've tried to have a look and just watch some of his stuff on YouTube, and he has a penchant for sniffing people's hair. Why?
And nibbling fingers.
Yeah, why?
Back rubs in public. Yeah. He's from that old school politician's way of, like, you touch people to express intimacy.
When was it ever okay to lick a finger? I want to know.
That's a Biden move, yeah. Also, not great for the corona era. Just
yeah.
We're riding with Biden.
Yeah.
So a question that I've just come up off the top of my head. Will we see more countries close their borders due to the coronavirus in the next few months or weeks? Or is it worse?
I think so, yeah, but it depends on what you mean by close. So, like, there has to still be
travel ban,
container ships coming through and stuff. Yeah. Like, civilization, there's a point at which if you're literally closing borders, civilization will collapse. Mm-hmm. Like, if you totally do it. You're going to see stuff like travel bans and...
Or something similar to how Italy's shut down the whole country.
I think Italy might be the model of the future, unfortunately. So yeah, that's not good, but it depends on, like, how far it spreads, how quickly. My concern is, like, what I'm expecting based on just, like, following public health experts on Twitter and stuff is, like, they're expecting this huge explosion in observed cases or confirmed cases of coronavirus because of the lag of testing and how many people gets sick and then it doesn't, we're going to see a huge spike, and that's probably going to have political repercussions. So we'll see. All right, gang, that's going to do it. WPR.pub/undiplomatic. Sign up for the newsletter, Back World Politics Review, because that helps back us. Also, you can throw money our way at buymeacoffee.com/undiplomatic. Catch you next time. Peace.